and fall on. It's pro-descension, I guess. Let's see if anybody can guess who is the speaker in that little clip. Let's see. So, can please, I like this line, can please as me they please of old. So, if the old romance retold can please as they did me of old, the wiser youngsters of today, if we can please them, then it's sailors' tales to sailors' tunes. Okay, so welcome to Payday. I have to think of which cult this is, which show is this. Payday.
I'm in charge.
Yes, girl, I'm in charge. Well, guess what? I noticed we have an email from Sue, Sky Goddess Sue. Just came in. It says, hi, Carol and Bob. Great show on Tuesday. The Dupes intro tour was good to catch on to because it's still a bit intimidating for me. The Ion post is where I'm going to work back from page 167, giving me a new focus. Yay! Thanks. And says that we'll not be able to tuck herself in bed and tune in the show. Well, you know, enjoy the pics. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that picture you're sending, Sue, of the guy with the pipe, it reminds me of the famous French comedian of the 60s, Jacques Tati, T-A-T-I. I don't know if that's him. I don't know if he wore a pipe, or maybe you took it. But as Dobbsy and ramifications, I see Carolyn forward a message. Carolyn just says, comments on the picture and that. Okay, here we are, and they're opening song. It was obvious. 99% of the people know that one. That's Heroes by David Bowie, and that was an actual play performance in the famous Paris Olympia Theater, Paris Olympia, in 2002. But then the somewhat noisy second situation was the Tony Williams lifetime, a sort of acknowledgement of jazz in a way, some kind of non-commercial stuff. Tony Williams says the Tony Williams Lifetime was a jazz rock fusion group led by jazz drummer Tony Williams. He founded the power trio with John McLaughlin on guitar and Larry Young on organ in 1969, and they went on to astound crowds with the speed of McLaughlin's guitar work, but they did not survive as long as Zappa did in the jazz rock format. But they did well in the downbeat circles in the jazz magazine world. They were recognized. Frank was ignored. Tony was recognized for his innovative jazz rock situation. What else is to say about that? What was the name of the song? It was called Sangria 4. Sangria. Now let's check that. Sangria 4. Yeah. Oh, it's Sangria 4-3. Sangria, Sangria 4-3, people. Part 1. Any votes to have part 2? Yes, send in your notes. Okay, so we have the usual, not Larry Lava this time, but his alter image. The Great Gazoo says, hey, Bob, where do I send my toe and fingernail clippings? You don't yet. Not until the battery, cold fusion battery, finds you, and then we have to make more, and then you can cash in on our expanding market. Then Matthew from Wisconsin, that would be Matthew Hurtado, says, what was Alex Jones doing talking about sailors on this show? Ah, good point there. Yes, that sounded like Alex Jones, didn't it? So you're voting that's Alex? No, it wasn't Alex Jones, Matthew. Wendy in Calgary, Alberta says, hi, Bob and Carolyn. Thanks so much for the tour of the Dukes Non-Physical website or clipping you did on the last show. Just listened to it this morning. Much appreciated. And I haven't got the link yet. I will be posting it when Steve sends me the link in the next 24 hours, and then everybody can click on and listen to it, rather than going to the archives, those who are already members of Dukes Non-Physical. Now, we played last week. I don't see any phone calls or anything yet, so I want to pick up where we left off last show, where I read Paul Levinson's take on the Romney-Obama election as a battle between the chip body and the TV body. Paul Levinson, not too familiar with my terminology, put it back to a more blander notch and said it was social media versus mass media. And you can hear me and Paul Levinson talking on McLuhan on Maui number 31, November 2011, the second last McLuhan on Maui. Paul was a guest. I want to read something difficult. Hopefully Tony Williams got new that kind of detachment, but let's hear Arthur Croker's take on the situation, talking about multi-bodies that we possess. Now, he did a book called The Will to Technology and the Culture of Nihilism. He did it, I don't know, 8 years ago, it was a while. And he analyzed the trinity of Martin Heidegger, Karl Marx, and Friedrich Nietzsche. Now, most people aren't reading these guys anymore, but Arthur Croker finds relevance via McLuhan and Dobbs of these thinkers for his at least university courses out there in Victoria, what is it, Vancouver Island in British Columbia. Well, he has this trinity, Heidegger, Marx, and Nietzsche, but he decided to make a new book called Body Drift. You get that? Body Drift. And now he's going to take on some women, you know, give the women a chance to talk about the multi-body situation. So he takes, he examines the writings of three famous professors in the postmodern feminist world. They go by the names of Judith Butler, Catherine Hales, and Donna Haraway. Now, Catherine Hales, I was reading her book, How We Became Posthuman, on page 222 of that book on September 11th, when I was interrupted by Esther Alka telling Carol not to go downtown. It was about quarter to 10 that morning. The subways were all screwed up, and Carolyn asked, why don't I come down to administer to you? And she said, turn on your TV. And we have never been changed since then. Until Lyon showed up, of course. Yes, a few years ago. We have been changed, but we got stuck there for a few years in a spam warp. Okay, so this is an interview with Arthur Croker. And as much as this is labyrinth of mind stuff, maybe someone will be interested in how he talks about the five bodies and makes it academically acceptable. So he was interviewed in San Francisco at the famous City Lights bookstore, which was started by, was it Lawrence Ferlinghetti back in the beatnik period in the 50s? And it's continued on, it's done well all these 60 years. So Arthur Croker, he's dropped in and was interviewed there. And he's interviewed by the founder of the Red Boat Opera, a portable theatrical troupe operating in the Bay Area. His name is Peter Maravillas. He's also events coordinator at San Francisco City Lights Bookstore. That's probably his day job. His night job is the theater group. So here is how the interview goes. Hopefully I can interview it. If anybody is really gets an extreme reaction to this, just in quick message, and I might consider the pain. Let's see if anybody is sending yet. Nobody yet. So here we go. So City Light starts off. Congratulations on your new book. You've covered quite a bit of ground since The Will to Technology and the Culture of Nihilism. In the earlier book, you dealt with the trinity of Heidegger, Marx, Nietzsche. While in this new book, Body Drift, you examine the work of Judith Butler, Catherine Hales, and Donna Haraway. Hales is H-A-Y-L-E-S, Butler is how it sounds, and Haraway is H-A-R-A-W-A-Y. If you have any daughters going to school and college in the humanities, this is who they read. This is what your kids are being educated through, via, and around. Butler, Hales, and Haraway, that's what... Now, boys can take the courses too, but this is the paramodern feminist movement, the ones who deal with post-chemical body issues. That's what they're up against. Okay, so he says, in your book, Body Drift, would you talk a little about the transition from one work, the old one, let's just say about the old boys, Heidegger, Marx, Nietzsche, and their relevance to paramodern issues, and the new women. How do you transition from one work to the other? How and where do these works cross over into each other's orbit? Because he's made a parallel, like I do. I make a parallel between LaRouche, McLuhan, and, say, Thompson. Parallels would be, for LaRouche would be Rush Limbaugh, for McLuhan would be Howard Stern, for William Thompson would be Oprah Winfrey. Okay, so Arthur says, the two books are closely related. In The Will to Technology, I explored the human impact of technology through the lens of Marx, Heidegger, and Nietzsche. They often use the word lens when they're talking about looking at something. So just as Ayn explores the impact at the beginning, in the early cash flows, the impact of speaking and language, words, and mortar, and then Ayn goes on to talk about the impact of the chip body, like Croker later, but here is Croker saying, I explored the human impact of technology through the lens of Marx, Heidegger, and Nietzsche. Specifically, I argued that while Marx's analysis of analysis of commodity fetishism, that means like object addiction, provided prophetic insights into the development of the digital commodity form, so that would be software imagery, the digital commodity form, he applied Marx to the New World, and Nietzsche's understanding of the will to power. Now, look, the will to power can be authority or power or what? You know, see, that's what's interesting. What's the will to power, and as opposed to taking your power? Nietzsche's understanding of the will to power, that was an early precursor of the contemporary technological condition with its fetishism of, quote, big data or data, distant reading, and augmented bodies. Look at that, augmented bodies. That's a term we can use if you want to explain this to your grandmother or your 35-year-old uncle. Use the infinitive body, say augmented bodies. So Nietzsche apparently was able to offer insight into the virtual world of information called big data, distant reading, and augmented bodies, while Heidegger captured the essence of the post-human condition with his concept of, quote, fully completed nihilism. Remember how Ion talked about we complete supplements, we create completement. We complete everything with Iondom. And here is Croker saying Heidegger completes nihilism. Can we say that Ion completes anarchism or socialism or capitalism or oligarchy? No, we can't say that very quickly. So Croker goes on after describing the roles of each of these three writers. In Body Drift, my focus is on three brilliant contemporaries. They always have to say who they criticize and critique and try to go past and push the envelope. They always say they're brilliant in academia. In Body Drift, my focus is on three brilliant contemporary representatives of critical feminism, Judith Butler, Catherine Hales, and Donna Haraway. In my estimation, says Croker, while Marx, Nietzsche, and Heidegger may have provided, now yes, they sort of say, hey, those guys, that was a great book I did, but, and they're useful, but actually there's something newer we have to deal with, and only these women do it. So he says, in my estimation, while Marx, Nietzsche, and Heidegger may have provided premonitory signs of the charred landscape of the technological blast, think of Wyndham Lewis's blast, his magazine in 1914, the charred landscape of the technological blast. Any of you guys feeling that way? Well, you definitely, many of you 2 years ago felt that way after listening to Project Camelot. You thought there was a charred landscape of technological blast and you were going to get blasted again. But you didn't know that Marx, Nietzsche, and Heidegger also were talking that stuff. So in his estimation, these guys may have provided adequate description of that. But it is the specific contribution of Butler, Hales, and Haraway to provide a deeply compelling account of the fate of the body in contemporary society. So we could look at this, that his previous book was about the landscapes of television and computers, the charred landscape. Now he's catching up to me and talking about the shrunken landscape to body scale, and the women have the handle on the body. In contemporary society, the fate of the body. And that ostensibly means the chemical body. What's going to happen to the chemical body? Haraway's concept of the, quote, informatics of domination, that's in quotes, represents a brilliantly congealed expression of Marx's commodity fetishism. So she's updating the landscape level of Marx's industrial products and how they dominated the poor worker, and it's being updated on the new body level by Haraway. So she's still dealing with commodity fetishism, but she calls it informatics of domination. Now, Butler is the thinker who has taken Nietzsche the furthest by literally forcing an account of what it means when power turns into itself. That's what I say, the android meme works for itself, extends itself for itself, not us, not the chemical bodies. You are being put on the sidelines until I'm done, by the second phase of technological evolution. And that's what Coker's getting at here when he says power turns into itself, not power for you or for the government. We will have a song by the Bonzo Dog Band later on this theme. So literally forcing an account has taken Nietzsche the furthest by literally forcing an account of what it means when power turns into itself, whether in the register of sexuality and gender or in the rhetoric of the war on terrorism or preventative detention and drone warfare. So those are expressions of power turning on itself. Now, what's happened to sexuality, to gender, war on terrorism, preventive detention, and drone warfare? And then he asked, and Hales, and Catherine Hales? Like Heidegger, of course. We've done Marx. That's Haraway. Butler is Nietzsche. So therefore, Heidegger has to be Hales. So, like Heidegger, Hales has a fully equivocal conception. Now, Heidegger, you might think, is a very extreme philosopher and something he's never run across once he took the philosophy courses. And he was sort of part of the existentialist world over there in Germany. He actually worked for the Nazis in the 30s. That's a bit of a scandal in his life. He took a position teaching under the Nazi regime and had to account for that after World War II at some point. Anyways, here's Heidegger, this, you know, what he was, what I just said. And then you have Hales. And if you look at a picture of Catherine Hales, she's a matronly suburban mom-looking person. But apparently her books are considered genius. She's very smart. Understands literature and science. She's brought together literature and science and novels and Pynchon and maybe even a little McLuhan. So she's like this unlikely person is like Heidegger because she has a fully equivocal conception of the technological post-human. That was the name of her book that I was reading on 9/11, How We Became Post-Human. She has understanding of both its dangers and possibilities. So she's not totally worried about being post-human. But she's taking a mediaecological stance, what we'd call the paramedia-ecological stance, and looking at the services and disservices. Then Arthur says, like all truly premonitory, that's a thought again, with that word, premonitory thought. Premonitory means prophetic or premonition. Like all truly premonitory thought, the critical feminism of Butler, Hales, and Haraway provides an evocative account of body drift as the emblematic sign of contemporary culture. In other words, the five-bodied syndrome is the main condition, context, medium of our situation. Now, of course, Arthur doesn't include the fifth body, the mystery body. He might personally, but he certainly can't do it in academia. We do that here. So he's basically talking about two or three bodies, chemical, TV, and chip. It might have a little astral in there, but not too much. So that's his opening statement, and he's saying this in front of a live audience at the bookstore, I'm assuming. Then City Light says, in the new book, you open the discussion with the haunting of the media image machine, haunting in quotes. So you remember we talked about the after image of the Android meme, the after image of this and that, so maybe this is what they're getting at. Discussion with the haunting of the media image machine by memories of the body. So yes, we see a lot over the last 20, 30 years, a lot of people trying to prop up the chemical body, rejuvenate it, make it healthy, make it pure, make it extreme, probe it, like those Jack Rabbit guys, what are they called? Jack something, the extreme sport of Jack something. They're playing with an after image because they're actually living in the chip body and the TV body, and they can't really see it, so they're haunted by the past, by the chemical body. So Arthur's on the right track when he opens the book with this haunting of the media image machine, that'd be the digital landscape of the Android meme, by memories of the body. And here's what's evoked. Genocide victims, missing children, accident victims are evoked. Can you talk about the idea of drift? What does it reveal about what is happening to us? What does it reveal about where we are headed, both culturally and as a species? So you got to include species, because Croker in his earlier books talks about sort of the abandoning of the human species. Now I'm going to check the in quick message. What do we got here? Richard. Richard's, he's not complaining about this. He's talking about our Andross, so we'll get to that, Richard. So back to Croker. Croker says, yes, Carolyn? You? Oh, just laughing, okay. Body drift, says Croker, is written at the trajectory. It's a very popular word, trajectory. That means like an arc of narrative or a span of spans, don't use the word time, a movement across a duration. So it's written at the trajectory of two opposing possibilities in contemporary culture. He's saying there's only two possibilities today, two opposing possibilities. On the one hand, we are living in the shadows of a gathering political and social crisis in which technologies of abjection, A-B-J-E-C-T-I-O-N, abjection, or the abject, is a very popular word in Ion's mouth. Ion refers to abject this, abject that, and even in the Cold Fusion recording that people are ordering, he talks about the abject, and it's a psychological condition, in reference to the makeup of the machine, of the Cold Fusion batteries. Very interesting that Ion puts psychological qualities into our battery in the course of explaining it. So these technologies, in which technologies of abjection, disappearance, inertia, and substitution increasingly triumph. So he's saying we are living in the shadows of a crisis because the Android meme is winning, because it just makes the chemical body useless. And, of course, that leads to, what's her name, Miss Huffington? Arianna Huffington, writing about stress as the most dominant situation. Now, do you notice I read her column, Carolyn sent it to me. She advocates her own little gadget as a solution, Carolyn. The whole column was to sell her her new invention, but her app. And now she says stress is the big problem in everybody's life today. Extreme stress. Well, Croker's breaking apart into calling it your chemical body is abject. It's almost like a wasteland. It's disappeared. It has inertia, and it's been substituted by other bodies. So that's one. On the one hand, we have that. He says the evidence for this is pervasive. Disappeared bodies, excluded ethnicities, prohibited sexualities, undocumented subjects, disavowed forms of imagination and hopes, and democratic aspirations. So disavowed forms of imagination, hopes, and democratic aspirations. But at the same time, the multiplicity of bodies, see that? There's no other academic in the world saying that. At the same time, the multiplicity of bodies that we are, and the multiplicity of hopes that we engender begin to dream again, fitting its wake, begin to dream again of counter trajectories of resistance, hope, and solidarity. Wasn't that what went on in Tailgate and Rewrite, or right here in tonight's show, or Matthew and Sarah's show, or anybody who has us on their shows, like Jeff Renz? We are counter trajectories. So we're going against the drift, the narrative of abject annihilation that you could think the chip body's doing to the chemical body and the astral body. So he's saying the services are, we have new dreams of new possibilities of resistance, hope, and solidarity. And he says, so we're caught between those two things. Now, we would not limit to that. I would say that the Android meme presents those two options and then squares it so that Arthur is not moving into quadrophenia. He actually calls what he does bimodern, not postmodern or paramodern, bimodern. So he's always dialectically, like the Marxists do, dialectically setting up poles. So he says, this moment of body drift is definitely global, pronounced, and truly enigmatic in its eventual outcomes. In other words, he's saying, isn't that a clue where it's going to go? Indeed, the language of body drift in all its complexity, contingency, that means changes, it's not constant, and hybridity, okay? That means hybrid stuff, mixing of things. Indeed, the language of body drift in all its complexity, contingency, and hybridity has now come to define the key trajectories of post-human culture. You see, people, you're living in post-human culture, and that's why we have the post or pre or para-human ion show up as the antidote. Mr. Croker doesn't have his finger on that pulse, but we actually have the third or fourth counter-counter squared trajectory offering. But, you know, you guys don't even know about the four bodies, and so Croker is at least giving me some academic backing here. And so that's quite a mouthful, he says. So the City Lights basically doesn't even respond. The City Lights interviewer, who was called Peter Marevelous, he doesn't even take on those points. He doesn't say, you sound like Bob Dobbs or Bob Neverett with your multi-body talk. But he doesn't know anything about me, we assume. Or he's not going to tell anybody he does. So City Lights goes on to another topic. Just leaves that mouthful that Arthur says and says, in the new book, you open the discussion with, in the second chapter of the book, he's talked about what the book opened with, Arthur answered. Now, in the second chapter of the book, you mentioned Judith Butler describing the, quote, shameless impurity of Antigone. Now, that's a famous classical play from Greece. The shameless impurity of Antigone, an ethical remembrance of Antigone in Butler's book called Giving an Account of Oneself. There's the modern software torture. People are always forced to give an account of themselves. They call that meditation, or they call that endless chatter in their minds, because the media is throwing images at them all the time that confronts their self-image. So we're always self-talking and looking for an account of ourselves and where we're at. Now, to bypass the stress of that is what we offer here. An ethical remembrance of Antigone. So somehow, as academics like to do, they like to find something way back there in history, or fake history, or book history, some classical parallel, and then say it's happening again. So Antigone, which right at the moment I can't tell you what it means or what they did, maybe Carolyn could look up Antigone for me. It's A-N-T-I-G-O-N-E, just as a filler, an ethical remembrance of Antigone in Butler's Giving an Account of Oneself, where Antigone breaks her silence to, quote, say what needs to be said. So I guess Judith Butler, as a professor, was holding a lot in, and she decided to be like Antigone, I assume Antigone did this, and say what needs to be said. The effect of such a commitment can be powerful. Now, isn't this silly? I mean, this woman...
But not if Antigone is the daughter of Oedipus and Jocasta. So.
What do you mean not? That sounds right. Oedipus set up a lot of problems, and Antigone had to live with it.
Yeah.
Maybe she exposed her father.
Yeah.
Kim, maybe that fits.
The name has been suggested to mean opposed to motherhood.
What's the name?
Antigone.
Oh, she's opposed to motherhood?
It may also mean against men.
Well, let's assume it's something like that, because Butler is a feminist,
mm-hmm.
And they get a little worried about
men. And she is the daughter of the accidentally incestuous marriage between Oedipus and the mother, Jocasta.
Okay, so she's in a strange situation, and she breaks the silence, and that's very powerful that she had the guts to do that, and Arthur's saying Judith Butler has got great guts. The effect of such a commitment to break the silence can be powerful. Then Arthur says, I am reminded of the repetition course of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Remember when they would repeat the words of the speaker? He says, having a speaker's words reflected back to them, to the speaker, gave their message a depth and meaning that went beyond what it normally would have been. I would like to talk about the importance of, quote, standing as witness, unquote. Well, that's what Nelson Dahl always said. He was just going to be a witness to the Herbert W. Armstrong truth of the Bible. And he wondered if he and I were going to be the two witnesses that are slayed at some point in wherever that is. Maybe it's in Revelations. And then they recharge their batteries and they come back to haunt the people who burnt them up. So if anybody, any duo is going to be the witnesses, it's going to be Greg and Ginny probably, right? I could have said me and you, but it could be Chad and Angela, Matthew and Sabrina, Ginny and Greg, all the power couples of Iandum. They could be the real two witnesses. So anyone of you guys want to die and then get re-inflamed immediately? Well, we'll let you do it. So standing as witness is what we see. What the hell am I doing here? Just a second. Sorry, I've been reading what the guy said. Sorry, Coker never said all this stuff. This is okay, so that's good. They digress into some interesting thoughts. It wouldn't have happened if I knew what I was doing. So you got to allow accidents. So starting over again, City Light says, in the second chapter of the book, you mentioned Judith Butler describing the shameless impurity of Antigone. I guess she didn't get good PR after she did this. An ethical remembrance of Antigone and Butler's giving an account of oneself, where Antigone breaks her silence to say what needs to be said. The effect of such a commitment can be powerful. I am reminded of the repetition course, says the City Lights guy, of the Occupy Wall Street insurrection. Having a speaker's words reflected back to them gave their message a depth and meaning that went beyond what it normally would have been. So he's impressed with the echo effect. I would like to talk about the importance of standing as witness. Will Arthur answer him? So Arthur says, in many ways, all of Butler's thought or writings is, quote, standing as witness. Certainly the book called Gender Trouble and another one called Bodies That Matter, these eloquently witness the disavowals, prohibitions, and exclusions necessary to maintain the social and violence involved in the regime of intelligibility that is the heterosexual masculinity. So, something to do with the father, the man, the patriarchy. They're pissed off. So, due to the regime of intelligibility that is the heterosexual masculinity, in other words, I guess it seems that men are smarter than women, is some meme, that evokes great social violence, which leads to disavows, prohibitions, and exclusions. And she would not take it. Indeed, Croker says, I approach Butler's thought under the sign of Nietzsche in drag in the theater of Judith Butler. That's in quotes. Nietzsche in drag in the theater of Judith Butler as a way of privileging, that means highlighting or emphasizing, as a way of privileging how her act of witnessing is not passive, but a form of thought that turns directly into the storm center of heterosexual melancholy. Croker and his wife, partner, Mary Louise, did a lot of that kind of writing about that, the despondent, bitter, angry white male thing. Years ago in books back in 1990 about panic sex and the hysterical male, the melancholy of the heterosexual. Okay, my sense is, says Croker, that the sheer force of the contemporary political crisis emerging from the conjunction of right-wing politics and primitive forms of neo-capitalism has transformed the direction of Butler's witnessing into a courageous and resolute remembrance of, quote, precarious life in the seemingly perpetual, quote, frames of war that is 21st century public life. So there's lots of war going on. That's sort of like the Book of Revelations, Armageddon stuff, in the TV landscape, and I guess the chip, not so much in the chip landscape. The chip is the carrier for the violence of Alex Jones versus Piers Morgan, the latest, you know, skirmish. So rereading that, Croker says, dealing with this heterosexual melancholy, my sense is that the sheer force of the contemporary political crisis emerging from the conjunction of right-wing politics and primitive forms of neo-capitalism, so these two things come together, has transformed the direction of Butler's witnessing into a courageous and resolute remembrance of precarious life. In other words, like Zappa once said, stand on a street corner in America, there's 200 ways you could die. So it's precarious out there in the seemingly perpetual frames of war that is 21st century public life. So they're using new words to talk about what you guys put up with every day. New words for new classes and new 19-year-olds coming to college. Precarious life rather than the stress of life. Frames of war rather than, what, stress of life, I guess. So City Lights responds to that with no comment and carries on to another topic. I would like to bring up Catherine Hale's Ethics of Complexity. Remember, I've told you people out there that when Ion says, don't resist anything, there's no evil, don't have ethics, morals, or any of these things, that Ion is reflecting an actual technical situation here. You cannot have values or ethics or morals in the conflicted body conflict or body drift. Now, there might be another way to have a sense of preciousness or value, which Ion offers, but on the surface, you're in a world of the ethics of complexity, and that's in quotes. Hales has, City Lights, Peter says, Hales has managed to bridge the gap between science and literature. Would you talk about the importance of the challenge that her work offers us? She's challenging you people. Where lies the relevance of immersion in the idea of the catastrophic, the chaotic, or in essence, crash theory? Now, crash theory is Croker's term. You know, you have this kind of theory, that kind of theory. Croker called it crash theory. And he writes in a panic mode. And he maybe he's even talking in a panic mode in the vein of crash theory. So where is the relevance of immersion in the idea of catastrophic and the chaotic when you have the bridge, the gap between science and literature bridged by Catherine Hales? Croker's response, and we're almost finished here, folks. Croker's response is, in the same way that Nietzsche once said that all of his thought was posthumous, that is, a form of thought that would only be fully understood later by those fully experiencing the sublimity and bitterness of nihilistic culture. So Nietzsche knew that he was ahead of his time and that his thought would be relevant to people 50, 100 years later. I don't know if that you could hold that up to be true, though. The Nazis used it in some way. It may have been a misinterpretation, but meanwhile, in the same way that Nietzsche's thought is posthumous, Catherine Hale's thought has the same sense of being fully ahead of its time. I remember Frank Zingroni told me years ago that Catherine Hale's was relevant to the 22nd century. He thought she was fully ahead of her time. I didn't feel so much when I read a book, but you know, I'm not your strange person. I'm your average person who's going to have a superiority complex. Any academic tries to tell me something, right? We're all like that. So Catherine Hale's thought is not going to seem to us, to Margarita or Allison, to be ahead of his time. They're going to say, or Tina, I knew that. I thought that all along. It's just the way the little spunky citizen is. Catherine Hale's thought has the same sense of being fully ahead of his time, an intimation of an approaching post-human condition, the full complexity of which is not yet fully understood. Well, this is where Arthur Croker, he does not deal with Phineas Wake and James Joyce and Wyndham Lewis and McLuhan. He knows McLuhan discusses this, but I think a lot of that was looked after by McLuhan. Anyway, but then Croker has to teach, you know, courses. He can't repeat McLuhan forever. He wrote a book on McLuhan in 1984, so he has to come up with new stuff for his students. You know, it's like you got to come up with a new season. So he's going to have to claim that Hales is McLuhan-esque. An intimation of the approaching discarnate or post-human condition that we do not fully understand yet. If it could be said, says Croker, that we are in fact living the last days of a larger technological destiny that involves simultaneous impulses, so he's going to lift the... This is where he gets sort of quadriphenic. He's going to show the different directions, impulses, he calls it, towards acceleration, drift, and crash. All three happen at the same time. So the larger technological destiny, that would be the huge landscape, is moving towards acceleration, drift, and crash. And he says, if that's where we are, we're in the last days of that, then Hales is the thinker who provides a digital alphabet for exploring the complexity of this larger technopoesis. Technopoesis, P-O-E-S-I-S. He says that working through different media, that's narrative, storytelling, poetry, and imagery, and in fact, at points, making a writing machine of her own split autobiography. A lot of these academics put their own story in there now. They're allowed to, sort of like the new journalism of the 60s, where you can throw in some personal stuff and not be so detached as old journalism had to be. Doing this, Hales' thought makes of the whole sweep of digital post-humanism a tutor text. T-U-T-O-R. In other words, it's like an alphabetic primer for you, for people who want to understand the present. It gives you the alphabetic background or step-by-step definition of terms. To read Hales is, in fact, to begin to experience the fractures, bifurcations, and liminality, not subliminality, the liminality that stretches across the skin of post-human culture. Now, we've got a minute and a half left. Let's check our messages. I'm going to read Richard's message in this last minute. We'll finish up Coker later. Richard from Saskatoon says, "Hey, Payday Gang, still taking RNA drops for 2+ months. Always enjoy the little euphoria I get from it. Changes in me are subtle but evident. Skin, muscle tone, and memory have improved as well as an old tendon injury healed. I do have a question. Did Ion ever clearly state what the intended purpose of chemtrails was? I've listened to the archives and know that he approved, but not sure why." So we'll have to address that. Do you remember, Carolyn, what Ion said about the great benefit of the chemtrails?
We needed the chemicals as food. We would eat them.
We require what the chemtrails are putting out.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not being put out for nefarious reasons. They're just being done by the military for some experimental something. And they're not trying to kill us. And then we find out that we can benefit from it. So that's we'll get back to Richard in the next hour. We got some more music that you cannot foresee. You have no clue what you're going to hear next. Variety's the name of the game. So let's see what Bill picked for the outro music.
AchieveRadio.com.
Are you or someone you love struggling with stress, anxiety, or less than perfect health? Hi, this is Pastor Ginny, and as a woman of faith, I spent many of my years in ministry burdened with anxiety and fear. In 2010, I met Dr. Carolyn Dean and took her recommendation to try RNA drops. Within days of taking RNA drops, my anxiety disappeared and my confidence came back for good. And the peace of mind that I once called a miracle has now become normal. Discover what RNA drops can do for you. Order a free sample today at www.rnafreesample.com. That's www.rnafreesample.com. You can get a free sample of RNA drops valued at $50 and pay only shipping and handling. Hear my testimony and the testimony of many others